Using statistics to lie is made easy with this informational read by Daryl Huff. Today, we will be discussing the intro and the first three chapters of this book. Inside, the code of lying is cracked using the simplest of statistics strategies. Let's begin. Hello, this is Victoria.
Nick.
Sean.
Shannon.
And for our quarter four benchmark, we are discovering how to interpret data using the power of statistics. With that being said, we read, discussed, and analyzed the best-selling novel, How to Lie with Statistics by Daryl Huff. This is what it's about.
So, in the introduction, they spoke about murder cases in newspapers, and they talked about how news companies put more murder cases on the first couple pages of the newspaper to make it show more murders happen in a city. What do you guys think about that?
That seems, it works really well, but it's kind of like obvious that they do that. It's just me.
I personally think, yeah, like Shannon said, it works. And if you want to get somebody's attention about something as bad as a bunch of murders in a town, then you should obviously try and put it out there as much as you can by exploiting it in the first three pages, because as we all know, you only read about the first three pages of a newspaper anyway.
Yep.
Well, there's nothing wrong with them doing this, because in the intro it says it misleads and it cannot depend on you, so you can't really get in trouble for doing something like that. It's like subliminal.
It still like takes away from like other news stories that are really like good stories or anything like that.
Especially if it's a lie, like not saying that, you know, they're lying about people being murdered, but they might be drumming up the data and they might be falsifying it or taking it on a larger scale.
So let's say there were 10 murders in a month.
Right.
And for that month, every week they broadcasted two murders on each page, on the front two pages.
Right.
So if let's say there was fundraisers going on for them entire months, but they put them on the very last page, would that have changed the outlook on it? What if they put the fundraiser on the first page instead of last?
Then people would be paying more attention to the fundraiser than they would be to the murders. But people seem to like more morbid things in their newspapers.
Yeah, people are attracted to drama. But, like, I do understand what you're saying, because, again, it's all about the front page. That's why when you see, like, sports stories, how they have the big color picture. Everything else is in black and white, but the color picture with the big impact font so that you can look. So when there's, like, three children dead on the front of a newspaper, your first response is, whoa, let me read that. What is that about? Let me care.
So,
well, maybe they do that, like, in the hopes that when you read that, you want to, like, see if there's more interesting stuff. But since they put everything, like, in the beginning and everyone knows that happens in the beginning, it might, like, might not help them as much as they would hope for.
I was about to say, actually, is with the way that they broadcast it, do you think they're actually trying to get people to react to it? Like, oh, I want to join a town watch trying to stop murders.
I think they're trying, they might have good intentions for it, aside from just getting their money from making people pay for a newspaper. But it's still, like, it's still lying with statistics, even though people still don't, like, pay attention.
Yeah, I think there is some good intention, because the point of the newspaper is to inform the public about everything that's going on. So it's basically a good thing, but at the same time, yeah, they're trying to make their money. And especially if newspapers aren't doing too well these days because of all the technology we have at our fingertips, then they're going to drum up as much as they can.
So you think that they're doing this to make money overall, but they're still trying to inform the public about everything?
Yep, I think that's exactly what's going on. They care, but, you know, at the end of the day, they still want to maintain their company and make a profit and pay all their employees. So at the end of the day, I would say that money is more important than what the public cares about.
Yeah, it is all about the money.
So money is power.
Yep. Always have been.
Okay, let's move on. In chapter one, it talked about a college that said that the average student who graduates makes $25,111 a year. And that seems a little too precise, right, guys?
Yeah, that was way too accurate.
I feel about this that they're using a sample from people that they can actually get to tell them their actual price. So if you're a big millionaire from going to their college, you're not going to worry about coming back or telling them how much you actually make. Or if you're poor, you might be too prideful to say it.
I'm just like, I make like 2 cents an hour. I'm a taxi driver, but I'm not going to tell you that.
I don't think, I don't think that they got a big enough sample. And I don't think it seems to me like they might have even only measured one class of students from the college. I think that they need to broaden their sample before they make wide claims as that, because I know for sure that when you come out of college, some of the statistics prove that you make over 40 grand a year. So it's really confusing when you only use one small group or one small population from a sample.
Okay, well, what kind of samples would you guys use?
I would say take, 10 students from each major that they offer and see if that changes their sample size.
I kind of think it was intentional, though, because if you think about it, again, like the newspapers, a college is a business. If they want to attract more people to their school, they want to make it seem like they're better than everyone else.
Right, but 25 grand a
year. It does seem.
That's not that great.
Yeah.
I think it was back in the day, but that's still, like, not that much.
I mean, yeah, back in the day probably, but I think that
when, like, something costs, like, 5 cents.
Yeah. What I would do is I would tweak Sean's idea. So, yeah, we have 10 students from every major, but I would do it for the past 10 years and compare each and every single, basically, data point and see how it changes over the years, and then make a general assumption of whether or not that's a good statistic or not.
Yeah.
Well, do you think all sample sizes would have some human error, even if you don't want it to?
Of course.
Yeah.
Because what if the person that you send the letter to asking for their monthly income lies? Like, they make $5,000 a month, and they don't want to tell anyone that, so they say, yeah, I make $10,000 a month.
Yeah, besides, do you know how many times in one of our math problems I miscounted the data?
Right. It happens. And human error includes lying. It's not, like, always an accident. Sometimes we just don't tell the truth, which is a very human thing. So, definitely, there's always human error.
Well, do you trust samples enough to get your data?
You have to make a bigger sample to make up for the fact that some people might be lying.
I would not trust a sample unless I could get all the data in front of me and even go to extremes as to have some people on lie detectors to see if they're actually lying about their
That's a bit
income.
Much.
Yeah, that's a little extreme, but I wouldn't trust just one sample of data. I mean, we've done so much work in class where we'd be a fool to only trust one sample of data or only trust one trial.
Especially when we did that project where we did the measuring of months. One person measured in inches, one person measured an infant, and you had to go through and fix everything so that it didn't get messed up.
Wow.
So, do you think of any other way to get the data besides samples?
Maybe make it a requirement at your college that they send back in maybe like a yearly income.
They should send in their actual pay stub, like the legit thing.
Just so they can touch base with their college professors or anything.
I don't think any of that's legal.
Maybe instead of making them send back their records and stuff, maybe just like ask the best students, because even if you have only the best year of that class, sending back their records that they might be proud of, then that's still technically lying with statistics, but you're only asking the best because you only care about the best.
Well, going back to what Nick asked, you said, is there any other way of getting data without collecting a sample? And I feel like all data is in sample form, and you can't really not collect data without having a sample. They're like, they go hand in hand. You can't collect data without having a sample. And I don't think you should collect data without having a sample.
You just need a little bit more than just one sample.
Right.
To make sure that you get the correct answer.
Right.
All right, what do you think the correct size would be for this? For the entire class?
I would say try and get to the closest amount of the entire class.
Yeah, or you could do the method that Sean said before, where you do 10 students from each major, and then you can tack on my idea from the past 5 years or so. And that's a really big sample. And then you'd be able to trust the data because you have a spectrum of numbers, and any individual person might be able to fall within those categories, within the samples.
Even if they fall in outliers, but they're easier to find.
Right.
Let's start talking about Chapter 2. Inside of Chapter 2, we run into the meaning of average and how many versions there are of the average. There is mean, median, and mode. We meet a real estate agent who is using the mean of the total incomes in the area to sell houses. There are a few wealthy people in the neighborhood whose income will influence the average. This is because the mean is influenced by outliers. Is this just plain lying or a good strategy? Okay, so, like I asked, is it lying, and what average do you think is the most misleading?
I think it's lying, but it's lying for a reason. So, yes, lying is bad still, but with the statistics, they actually have numbers to make their lying look like it's actually proving something. So they're using it to actually get a fan base to their topic.
It's kind of like they're lying for greed.
Yes. Basically.
Well, personally, if the numbers are correct, then the statistic is correct. But what they're using it for and how they're using it is where the lying part comes in. Because yes, you get an average of numbers and you say the correct average, then yes, your statistic is right. But just because your numbers are right doesn't mean what you're applying it to is correct. So it is lying, but if the math is correct, then I guess it's more of a fib, not really like a lie.
I wouldn't call it lying. Like, it's just misleading. Like, that's the definition of misleading.
Right.
Because they're not telling you anything that you can't like look up and be like, oh yeah, that's right. But they're giving you whatever they want.
I really feel like the average that's most misleading is the arithmetic one. Because it's just so easy. One small outlier and it's completely over.
Exactly. Like, one outlier. And like the story inside of the book where the man uses his most wealthiest of the people in the neighborhood, and they tip the scale for the property value of the whole entire neighborhood. And because they're so rich, they influence the way that everything goes.
So, our most famous fan, Mr. Miles, asked us to take one of the quotes from the beginning of the book. So I chose, there are three kinds of lies: lies, damned lies, and statistics. I think that all of this about Chapter 2 really ties into the statistics and damned lies part of that quote.
Oh yeah, why?
Because it really, like, they're using their damned lies to actually, like, formulate a statistical base.
I think the arithmetic average is the most misleading, because like they said in the example, you can have like a whole bunch of big shots, or even just like one or two big shots in the average, and you can make it seem as though everyone gets paid a lot. And then I think the mode is the least misleading, because more often than not, there's gonna be a lot of people who aren't getting paid that much, and if you add them into it, and since there's so many of them, people see, oh, a lot of people don't get paid that much.
I think that the mode is the most misleading, simply because if you have a bunch of trials of data, and say your goal is to get 100, say you only get 100, like 5 out of the 10 times, If you say, I got a score of 100 5 out of 10 times, but you got a score of like 30s and 40s all mixed in there, it sounds good, but if you look at how many you actually have compared to how bad you did, then it doesn't matter at all. So I think that's the most misleading, because they base it on how many you have, and that's not always right. It's about, you know, what adds up and what's fact.
So it's like it just depends on the situation, really.
Yeah, it depends on the situation.
I agree with Victoria, because if we tie it back into a company type situation, you're going to have a lot more workers than high-end like management staff, where the managers will make more money. The workers won't make nearly as much. So you're going to have a larger spread of the workers' data shown than the management data.
Right.
But I feel as though, like, if you go, you're going to start at the bottom, so you might want to know like where you're going to start out before you make your way out.
Graphs can blur and exaggerate, and they hide what's there because people don't really understand what they're seeing on a graph. And when it can be either true, it can be clear to show the facts, or it can only show you a narrow slice of what they want you to see, or they can broaden the scale and make everything very confusing, so that when you glance at the graph, you see a couple of numbers and the big ones are important and the little ones are important, and you don't really look at why this all matters.
So, with our famous fan, Mr. Miles, he asked us to look up graphs that distort data. So, for my graph that I looked up was on the Ivy League coach for colleges, and it has a graph here that shows acceptances from regular decision to early decision, and they have the early decision acceptances so much higher than irregular decision, which I could believe that could be true. They want somebody who's more inclined to go to their college, but I would also believe that maybe they just don't accept as many people after the early decision is done. Also, I believe you have to pay to do the early decision for most colleges.
So, with my article, it was with Fox News, they actually did a graph for Obamacare enrollment, and they made this the y-axis, they completely took it off the air. They didn't show the y-axis and made it so that it looked like it was worse than it was.
Right.
And they actually had to come out and publicly apologize for it and then fix the graph. And when they did, it was nowhere near as bad as it was. And it was one of the, like, most obvious mistakes.
For my graph, it talks about how the cost of going to college, like, tuition and room board is going up, but, like, not necessarily how much people make after they graduate. And, like, there's a lot of issues with this, because one of them is that just because the cost of college is going up, it's not like someone's going to, like, get out of college and, like, work until they're, like, 23 and then not pay it off.
Right.
So, like, after this becomes, like, really obsolete. And another thing with this is that it's more like you have to, like, have background information. In this graph, it looks like he's trying to say, like, there's no point of going to college. But, like, people who graduate from college make much more than people who just went to high school. So, like this is, like, not really a point to this graph. But I see what he was trying to get at.
ABC News reported a misleading report about guns in America. What they did was they conducted a poll from their viewers about who owns a gun in their home and who doesn't. What wound up happening was, once ABC got that information, they made a graph and they labeled it the amount of guns people have in America, like basically who owns a gun in the entirety of America. And they should not have done that, one, because they did not do a complete sample of America, and two, they changed the scales of the graph to make it look like they did a whole population of people when they only did the viewers of their show. And what it turned out was, they said that only 33% of people have a gun in their home, when the actual statistics is about 47 to 50% of people have a gun in their home. So it was very misleading, and I mean, they didn't get in trouble for it, but, you know, it just goes to show what's on the air.
This is a good example of what Chapter 3 talks about. People often skew the data by changing the scale or leaving out a chunk of the data. As you can see, this does not work well.
So Chapter 4 talks about how a base number is in the center of like a stretch of data. So they were talking about IQ mainly in Chapter 4, that being at 100 is average. Then they did a test with two students. One got a 98 average and the other one got a 101. But so they considered the 101 gifted and the 98 mentally challenged. But they didn't take into account that IQ fluctuates when you do a test, meaning that at 98 you can get 5 points above or below that score, but they don't count that data in, meaning that kid could have been 101 along with the other one, but because of the way the test was structured and taken, they got put below. Do you think that's right?
It reminds me of the false positive, false negative thing at the airport where the alarm would sniff out for bombs. And it shows that actually only a small percentage of the people who do get a false, what is it, a false positive?
Yeah.
A false positive, you know, it's a false positive. So basically, they're basically being labeled and they're like going through all this trouble for something that's not even their fault. And I mean, to take emotion completely out of this, at the end of the day, the machine is just doing its job and it does have errors. But when it comes to IQ, I think that there should be a bigger margin for error than there is, because now a lot of people are being labeled mentally challenged when they could have been, you know, gifted. And, you know, that's not their fault.
Yeah, and being labeled mentally challenged, especially in this society nowadays, it's a lot worse than just saying, oh, well, you didn't do so well on an IQ test.
Right.
You can use your IQ as a way of saying, give me this job because I'm smart. But if you have an IQ that's like, oh, yeah, you're mentally challenged, so we don't want you. You're not smart.
Right. I really do feel as though they should, like, put that deviation in. Like, with the false positives, it, like, when you looked at it, it didn't seem as much, but when you put it on, like, a much bigger scale, a lot of people are affected by this.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel as though a lot of people who are considered mentally challenged, mm-hmm. aren't really, but, like, they're just labeled because of stupid IQ tests.
Right.
Like the SATs.
So, in Chapter 5, it talked about GWAS graphs. Basically, graphs that, like, severely skew data in one general direction. Our favorite fan, Mr. Miles, once again, gave us a link that talked about graphs that distort data, and most of them were talking, well, most of the graphs represented tax cuts and elections, sometimes sports. And the article actually talks about, in general, like how just changing the y-axis on it can drastically shift that graph to represent something that you want it to.
Right. What I think is cool about that is the numbers are still the same. It's actually admirable. The numbers are still the same. Everything is still the same, but now everything is distorted to the eye, and you think that there's something else going on. And when actually it's the same graph, like back in math class, Mr. Miles showed us a scatter plot, and then he showed us another scatter plot that was exactly the same, except the y-axis had been distorted terribly. And, you know, it took us a minute, but we were like, hey, that's the same graph. And he was like, oh, I'm glad that you see that it's the same graph, because a lot of people will try and get you with that kind of false information.
So, like, you can say, like, they're tricking you, and it's like, this really is misleading, but there is no way lying to you again. You. Some people might say it's lying, but it really isn't. Just that you have to look closely and look out for like stuff like this.
And then like it's also like when we were learning about, you know, when he showed us that scatter plot that was ice cream sales and drownings in the summer.
Yeah.
They how they distorted it that way and made it seem like ice cream caused drownings, whereas to really it's in the summer and more people swim in the summer.
Yeah, lacking variables.
Another thing is when news companies, mainly Fox, put up pie charts that don't add up to 100%. But
right.
For this one here, it's a 2012 presidential candidate run, and it has Mitt Romney's percentage at 60%, Sarah Palin's at 70%, and Huckabee at 63%.
Doesn't add up at all.
That doesn't add up to 100, but they're still putting out 100% skill.
Good old Fox.
Yep.
They're real liars.
Going off of our previous podcast about chapters 3, 4, and 5, we talked a lot about graphs. In chapter 6, they talk about 1D graphs and how they can use graphs that have a little bit of data to lie a lot. How do you guys feel about that?
I think the idea of using a little bit of data to cover a broad topic is, you know, quite clever. It's misleading, of course, but I think that, you know, using that in that way, like I said before, is clever because, you know, you can trick people into believing that, you know, you survey the whole entire country when you only survey 3 states.
People don't have a very large attention span most of the time, so they want to get the data as quickly as they can. So by doing this, they think that you're just trying to help them out, but instead you're just tricking them.
Yeah, like, I have like the attention. I've been told I have like the attention span of like a melting ice cube, and if I saw a graph that might not have all the data on it, but it looked pretty good, I'd just be like, oh, okay, whatever, because you just look at it at a glance. You're not actually trying to figure out what's going on.
Good point. Good point. If you guys were to survey a broad spectrum of people and create graphs for it, would you try and make your graphs look scarier?
I would show what's actually there. And, you know, and I would base it off of that information. So say if I was just surveying how many people watch TV in the country, and, you know, obviously I can't survey the whole entire country. So if I do a sample size of about 100 people, I can just say within this region, this is how many people watch TV. And then from there, you can make your own basis and assumptions. But, you know, I'm not going to tell you something that I don't have. I'm not going to lie to you.
I think, like, it's a good idea that if you're doing something that requires a big sample size and you realize, oh, hey, I can't actually get this sample size, it might be a better idea and more beneficial to everyone if you just change what you're saying. Maybe not instead of the whole world, just this region, and then let people go from there because they're going to do what they want to do.
If I wanted to like trick people with the statistics so it's in my favor, I would do the same thing, because if you have less, it not only makes them want to read it more, but also the less I have, the less I have to like try to lie with.
So less is more, basically.
Right. Let's talk about Chapter 7. Chapter 7 is about semi-attached figures. It speaks on how you can create a correlation between variables even when they don't really match up. The quote inside of Chapter 7 goes, "If you can't prove what you want to prove, prove something else and demonstrate that they're both the same." What do you guys think about this?
I feel as though this is also a very clever way to lie about statistics, because you're not telling them anything wrong, you're just leaving it up to them to assume, and if they assume something by themselves, they're at fault and not you.
Right.
It's like, it's kind of like avoiding the blame, like how you, like, does anyone remember getting in trouble when you were in, like, in kindergarten?
Mm-hmm.
And I know I have a friend who has a little brother, and he goes, oh, my big sister did it. It's kind of just like pushing the blame off of yourself so it doesn't look like you're doing anything.
Right.
I think that it's not so much pushing the blame off of yourself.
Mm-hmm.
It's more so, it's easier to ask for forgiveness than ask for permission.
Yes.
So, if you go through a different means of getting your information, meaning you go somewhere else, look at some other data, and then relate it back to it, they can't really blame you nearly as much as they could if you were just to, let's say, survey 1,000 people and say, this is the one thing that's happening.
Right. I remember when we were
talking about the ice cream sales and drownings and, you know, how they relate. And, you know, the only way they really relate is through the summertime, and that, you know, they increase because of the summertime. But, you know, they were trying to make it seem as though because it's the summertime, these two things are related. But, I mean, ice cream sales and drownings don't really have anything to do with each other, do they?
Well, some people don't ask themselves the simple question, does this make sense? Because they think everyone, like, goes and, like, checks the data and, like, oh, these guys know what they're doing.
Right, as long as there's some kind of math or some type of number involved, people glance over it, and, you know, that's really what's the problem here.
I think it's more of the calculus effect, where if you see a large number mm-hmm. and, like, an equation to go with that large number, you're just like, nope, I'm just going to accept that they did their math and walk away from it.
Yep.
Right.
Yeah. Chapter 8 talks about cause and effect and how people will personally mix them up to put them in their favor. How do you guys feel about this?
I feel that cause and effect is a general thing that's always there, even outside of math. So every causation has a effect to happen on it. So let's say I push a ball. That ball is going to roll until the friction underneath of it slows it down. The cause was me pushing it. The effect was it slowed down. So I feel that the cause and effect in math is more to react and effect out of the people that it's being shown to, not as much react and effect out of the thing that it's studying.
I think it's really difficult to mix cause and effect up. And I mean, you have to use a lot of numbers to cover up the fact that you're doing that, which makes it all the more clever of the person who's doing it. Because, I mean, one thing happens, and therefore, this happens. A plus B equals C. We all know how that goes. But, you know, it's really hard to say, you know, that it rained, it's raining, therefore there are clouds. Or, like, you know, like, to say things in a backwards meaning and then to still have people believe in it really shows that, you know, lying with statistics is an actual thing and that, you know, it really does happen.
I really feel like it's really just, we make it a little too easy for people to lie to us like that, because as Americans, we kind of just think everything is kind of given to us. We have everything we need, so we don't really think that when they're lying to us, that they're lying to us, because we don't really care.
So you guys don't think there's like an easy mistake to make, or?
I think it's a purposeful mistake to make. So, if you're doing things with effect and cause instead of cause and effect, then you basically tell them what's happening, and then you make something up to make that happen.
Yeah, it's like, you know, when the news, you turn on the news, and they're like, 60 people died. That's the effect. And then it's like, tune in at 6 o'clock to see why. So, you know, they got you hooked because they told you the effect, and now you're trying to figure out why that happened.
All right, now let's talk about Chapter 9. In Chapter 9, the author coins a term, statisticulate. Try to say that 10 times fast. In this chapter, they talk about how when somebody writes something in an article and they make the reader do math, the reader just more than likely will assume that it's true. So what does that make you guys think?
I feel that it's lying to the basis of the public, because most people might not have taken statistics, and then if they do the math, they'll get it wrong. So,
or they make like a lot of assumptions.
I think when you make people statisticulate, I think it's a really interesting method, because when you make people have to do math or have to take a long time to, you know, look at a graph, and you have to make them go further than what you're giving them, then they're automatically going to believe that, you know, that this is a legit thing and this is real, because, you know, you're making them do math to figure things out and to get the answer. So they're like, whoa, there's no way in the world this is fake and that they're lying to me because you just made me do a bunch of math.
I feel as though people that get cocky while they're trying to do math, and you're like, I know how to do this and I trust myself. So when I get this done, that means that's automatically what it means.
And it kind of like, it kind of gives the reader more of like a sense of like accomplishment. Like, oh, I did this thing. So maybe because they didn't do it, so maybe I'm actually right. Maybe they don't know what the answer is or whatever it is. And they kind of just feel a sense of accomplishment where they're like, I can't really be wrong, can I?
Yeah, when like you're reading an article or the news reporter says, you do the math. When they say that line, then you're like, you know, you start to count in your head, like, okay, let me do the math. Whoa, that is a big amount. And you're like, whoa. And but really what's happening is they just made you do the math so you and, you know, make you feel like you did something.
And sometimes you're like, no. And you're like, I'll take your word for it.
Right.
Yeah. You could just be like, I see numbers. Let me back away from this slowly. Just accept it for what it is.
Right.
In chapter 10, it talks about how to talk back to statistics. Basically, it's a cheat sheet for the readers to tell them how to ask questions when they're looking for answers out of a statistical base. Do you guys feel this was useful to be put in the book?
Yeah, I think after showing you all of the methods and all of the things to look for and all of the things to see through, they show you, you know, the solution to the problem, which is a really nice way to wrap up a book and a really nice way to, you know, show that, hey, you know, there's a way through this. It's not just like, you know, they're lying to you. There's a way to fight back.
I feel as though it's good that they put it at the end, because at the beginning, I would have no idea what to do with this. I'd be like, oh, hey, thanks for the advice, bro.
And then also it's kind of like there are a lot of people who will be like, oh, they're lying to you, but then they don't actually tell you how to fix it. It's just kind of like, hey, here's this problem, but I'm not going to tell you how to fix it because I don't care enough.
Yeah, or you don't know how. Like, some, it, you know, it makes the reader feel grateful that this is a fixable problem, because, you know, sitting in front of your TV, you just start to think, you know, all of this crap is lies. So, you know, and you can't do anything about it.
Basically the silver lining in a thunderstorm.
Yep.
Okay, guys, how do you guys feel about the book?
I feel that it's a knowledge base for people who don't necessarily know about statistics. So it tells you what's wrong with it, and then it also tells you how to fix it.
I appreciated how easy to understand this book was. And, you know, I like the way the examples were given for each chapter. And I like, you know, how it all made sense and how at the end they told you the solution to the problem. One thing I would change about it is that, you know, the title, because I don't feel like it's lying. I really don't feel like it is lying at all. While helpful, I really feel like this book is dangerous, not in like a bad way, but in like a way to wake up everybody. And if everybody read this book, you know, they would be, you know, a lot better for it. And, you know, people would have to change their ways and big corporations couldn't lie anymore like that.
It's like this book was, it was easy to read for people who don't really think mathy. I'm going to be an artist. I'm going to art school and I'm not a very mathy person. I get confused by this stuff and big numbers scare me. And this book didn't really use that many numbers. It used words to express what the numbers meant. And it gave the reader a sense of accomplishment. Hey, I finished this book. I'm not going to completely fail for not knowing what's going on in the world. And it gives the reader just a sense of, oh, I can fix this. I'm not completely going to be used.
Yeah.
I feel as though the fact that they put in a lot of images to help with all their like facts made people more willing to read this book. Because I know a lot of people didn't want to read it when they heard how many pages it was. But when they're like, oh, hey, there's a lot of pictures in it, and it helps you explain through images. Like, oh, okay.
As for me, I'm going into computer science, and I'm going to take a minor in mathematics. So if I have to sell a program or something like that, this would be very useful for me because I can use statistics to necessarily lie with my numbers, but also help my own profit gain.
So who do you guys recommend this book for?
I would say up-and-coming businessmen or people who watch the news all the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like I would recommend it for people who are unemployed.
I feel as though like this affects everyone, so anyone who has a chance to read it should read it.
I feel like it's just the kind of book that when you really want to know what's going on and you want to know what you can do to make sure that you don't get completely screwed by big corporations, it's a good idea.
All right, that was our review for High Life Statistics. We hope you enjoyed.